We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hey, y'all. My name is Wendell, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date's October 18th, 1994. And it is a treat to be able to share with you guys and gals this morning just a little bit of what happened to me and what it's like and where I'm at now. October 18th, 94 was a bad day. It was a great day looking back on it, but at the time, it was not a good day. I woke up in a little motel out in California, south of Santa Barbara, and I came to, I should say, and I had been on a four-day binge and came to in this little motel, and oh, man. You know, the book talks about that gift of desperation. And here I was stuck in a little motel out in the middle of nowhere, 2,500 miles from anybody that gave a damn. And, you know, how did I get there? Boy. And it was one of those situations where I had been to treatment a month and a half before that in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm originally from Western North Carolina. I called Asheville, North Carolina home for many years and currently live in South Carolina. But anyway, that day I came to and, you know, how in the world did I get there? What happened? I'd gotten out of treatment a month and a half before that and was all gung-ho and was supposed to go to this long-term treatment place in Atlanta. And I went back to Asheville and packed up some stuff and put some stuff in storage and got a call from a lady that I'd been dating for a while. And she was out in California temporarily on her job. It had taken her out there. She called me and we talked and she was in desperate straits and wanted me to come out there and help her. She was having challenges with her ex-husband, custody of their kid. And anyway, I get out of treatment and this shows how sick we are, right? I get out of treatment in Charlotte and go back to Asheville and pack up. And here I am and she calls and I think it's a good idea for me to jump on a plane and I was supposed to fly to Atlanta and go to a long-term treatment place. And lo and behold, no, I had to get on another plane and fly out to LAX and Santa Barbara. And she meets me in Santa Barbara. And, you know, here I am, the white knight come riding up on the white horse. I'm going to save the day and make everything okay. And wow, you know, I look back on that and I think, boy, how sick are we? How confused and how our perception, even though I got just a few days, couple of weeks sober, I think that I can do something like that. As it turned out, I worked for her company for a month and a half out there. And we were running up and down Southern California doing resets and stores for a greeting card company. And I was going to meetings. I had listened. I had paid attention. You know, you guys kept telling me to go to meetings, do 90 and 90, get a sponsor. And here I was out there without a permanent address. And back then we didn't have cell phones. I had one of those beepers on my side and we were in each town probably two or three days. And so the first thing I'd do when I got to a new city would call AA and find out where the meetings were close by. And I'd go to a meeting that night and I, you know, introduce myself and try to get a couple of phone numbers. But, you know, I was going to be gone in a day or two and we were going somewhere else. And I'd do the same thing there and do the same thing in the next city. So for the first month or so of my sobriety, here I'm running up and down Southern California, going to different meetings. No sponsor, no home group, just trying to be supportive of this lady and the challenges that she was going through, trying to make a decision whether, you know, that was going to be a permanent deal, whether she was going to get the job and transfer out there. And I had a looming court case still pending in Asheville, North Carolina. And it's funny, I remember this other day, I called my attorney up. I remembered it the day before, and I called my attorney up and I said, oh, by the way, Stan, hey, man, I ain't going to make it to court tomorrow. And he was like, all right, why? And I said, well, you know, I talked to you and I told you I was in treatment a month or so ago and getting sober. And I'm out here in California and I just, I'm sober, but I can't make it to court tomorrow. And he just laughed, and I could, without even seeing the expression on his face, I could just picture him shaking his head and going, well, okay. Just know that it's going to be a warrant for a failure to appear in Asheville. And if you ever come back this way, I would walk lightly and give me a call sometime if you ever want this to go away, if you ever come back to Western North Carolina. And I said, okay, buddy, thanks. And I'll tell you in a few minutes how that all ended, but 30 some days, I picked up a 30-day chip out in California. And like I said, no home group, no sponsor, just running the roads, going to different meetings all up and down Southern California. And things got to be a little stressful between me and this lady, and with her job and not knowing the uncertainty of whether we were going to be there full time or not, she started putting a lot of pressure on me to find a job. And I was like, okay, how in the world do you find a job when you don't have a permanent address out here? Don't have a permanent phone or cell phone number. I got this 800 beeper number. And who in the world is going to call me and say, yeah, come on in, we want you to start work Monday? So I was thinking that was going to be an impossibility until we got a permanent address and a permanent phone number. But there was a lot of stress and a lot of angst between us. And she dropped me off at that motel that I was telling you about on October 18th, rolled around. And things were not good between us. She dropped me off there and she said she had to fly back to North Carolina to go to court with her ex-husband about their kids. And she said, you got to have a job by Monday when I get back or we're done. And I remember standing there looking at her like, really? Okay. Here I am. No permanent address. You know, all those reasons I've already given you that in my mind, nobody's going to hire me. And she pulled out of the parking lot and took off to LAX, fly out of town, and I'm standing there. And I remember going into the motel room and going, oh, man. Oh, what am I going to do now? I had, I don't know, $25 in my pocket, something like that. And, oh, the man that I was will drink again. And I didn't know what y'all meant when you said that and when I heard it in the rooms. And I heard just enough in the rooms to start to maybe realize that I might be able to stay sober. But when she dropped me off at that motel room, at that motel, and said, get a job, have a job by Monday or we're done, that panic, the fear, the, oh, desperation, you know, the book talks about, all set in, and I made a beeline for the grocery store. And out there, boy, in California, they sell liquor in the grocery stores. You know, that was a big shock for me coming from the mountains west of North Carolina. So I walked down to a grocery store and got a fifth of liquor and came back to the room and tried to figure it out. And what am I going to do? Where am I going to go? Oh, the next day I walked down to a real liquor store so I could take the what money I had left and buy a big half gallon. And, you know, that proved to me what you guys have been telling me in the rooms, that, you know, this disease of ours is progressive. And we stop for a little while and start back, whether it's, you know, a month, 2 months, 2 years, whatever, that disease is right there, ready and able just to knock us back down again. And anyway, the end of that was a 3-day binge, and me called my brother a couple of times. That was the saving grace that I had. He worked for a travel agency up in Boone, North Carolina, and he had an 800 phone number. So he was the only one in the family that I could call and stay in contact with. And, you know, by that time in my drinking career, I'd reached the point that I didn't feel like the family really wanted to talk to me a whole lot. And he was the one I would reach out to and say, man, what am I going to do? Do you think Dad will help me out? Do you think I can get we call Dad and talk to him and see if I can get a ticket back to Asheville? And anyway, a couple of drunk calls in the middle of the night didn't help matters any. But the third or fourth day I was there, when I had to check out and the hotel was kicking me out because I didn't have any money for another night, George called me that morning or I called him, whatever. He said he had talked to Dad, and he said, Dad's going to buy you a ticket to fly home. And I've got you booked on a flight, blah, 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 at 5:30 this afternoon, da, 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 da. And this was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was going, oh, man, it was like a relief. Okay. He said, do you think you can get to the airport? I'm like, yeah, I'll walk. I don't care. I've been calling homeless shelters all morning long trying to figure out where I'm going to go. I'm sure I can find a way to the airport. So anyway, and that's funny because I called the pastor of this church that I had gone to a little Presbyterian church out there one Sunday a few weeks before that. And I called the pastor of this church and I said, look, I know you don't remember me, but I met you a couple of weeks ago and told him my situation. And he said, you know, I think I may have somebody that can help you. And he made a phone call and he said, this guy's on his way out there. He'll give you a ride to the airport this afternoon. I don't know what y'all going to do between now and then. And he described the guy to me and told me his name. And sure enough, about 30 minutes later, this dude pulls up in front of my room in this little old beat up Pinto. And he got out and we introduced ourselves to each other. And I, you know, looked down at his dashboard and I saw this big old Bible that was sitting on his dashboard, and I'm thinking, oh Lord, no, I don't need a whole lot of preaching this morning. No, I was starting to feel, I was already hung over and shaking and puked a couple of times. So I was like, just desperate. But at the same time, this gentleman was not one of us. He, however, did know a lot about us and our disease. And his dad had started the first homeless shelter in Santa Barbara back in the mid-50s, I think. And so he had grown up with a lot of experience of seeing his dad and his family help out alcoholics and drunks that, you know, were in dire straits. And so it was really a godsend. It was really cool how it all happened. He gave me a ride back over to his house, and I hung out with him most of the day and started feeling worse and worse as the day went on. And bless his heart, he tried to, you know, he tried to fix me something to eat and tried to play. We listened to some tapes, some spiritual stuff. And I was like, you know, I was just wanting to get on that plane and hurry up and get back to Western North Carolina so I could at least try to figure out a game plan on what to do. And God bless him. That old guy gave me a ride to the airport and dropped me off. And, you know, I ended up flying back to, actually, it was one of those late night red eye flights. And my dad met me in Nashville at the airport the next morning, 7 a.m. or something. And that began another journey. And boy, you know, how in the world, how did I get there? How in the world, I'm 38 years old, do I find myself in the situation I did out in California, stuck, stranded, broke, drunk? You know, I didn't just wake up one morning and say, oh, gee, you know what? Today's a good day to be an alcoholic. I think I'll just start drinking a whole bunch today and see if I can be an alcoholic. That is not the way it happened. To give you a little background story just of who the family that I grew up in, I'm the oldest of five. I had a neat childhood. I had a really good childhood. My dad, and without telling his story, he's got a really cool story, but he's dead and gone now. He died in 2015, but dad had reached his business career goals at age 27 and was, as they called him back then, personnel manager, human resources director, is what we call him now, a paper company, and they had plants all over the country. And at age 27, he had reached his business career goals, and God kind of tapped him on the shoulder and said, you know what, there's more to life than this. And him and my mom had become involved in the church and were youth directors for the senior high group at church that we attended. And he had developed a relationship with one of the associate pastors there and felt like God was calling him to go in the ministry. So he resigned from the dream job that he had just gotten about 6 months before that and packed up a wife and at that time, three kids. And we took off to Richmond, Virginia to go. He went to seminary for 3 years. And at the end of seminary, he heard a gentleman speak from Indonesia and felt like God was calling him to go into the mission field. And so we took off to Indonesia for 3 years. Now, that being said, our family or our immediate family thought Dad had just slap lost it. You know, here was a guy that, you know, graduated from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and had a couple of successful jobs and was climbing the corporate ladder. And all of a sudden he was there, and we had moved into the big new house in Charlotte and the new cars and all that stuff. And him and I talked about that later on. And he said that was that was his big turning point, was that it wasn't all about the toys and the new house and cars. And as a matter of fact, he said in one of his talks that he was standing outside of a stereo store in a mall, looking just from the outside, looking in and looking at all the stereo. Back then they had all these big reel to reels, and he was standing there looking and all this equipment and all this stereo stuff this guy had in this store. And he thought, you know, all the stuff I got at home is better than anything he's got in this store. And that's when it hit him. And he said, you know, he just started crying, and he decided to call his friend down at the beach down where we had been living, said he needed to talk to him. And so that's kind of my dad's story, but it was a need growing up. So I went from, you know, Dad took us to Indonesia. I could talk forever about those 3 years. That was a fun time. We lived in the capital of Indonesia. We lived in Jakarta our first year, and that was certainly a huge culture shock for this little middle-class kid from Western North Carolina. And then we moved to Ambon the next 2 years and lived in, and Ambon is a small island about 500 miles northwest of Australia. And we did homeschooling and at that time, we had had, while we were at seminary, while Dad was at seminary, we had, my younger brother was born. And then we get to Indonesia and we're there for a year. My youngest sister was born in Indonesia. So by this time, there's five kids and mom and dad. And, oh, man, I had my own outrigger canoe. As soon as I did my schoolwork in the morning, it took a couple hours and I could zip through my schoolwork and get all that done. Then I was free for the rest of the day and I could jump in the canoe and take off out across the bay and go fishing or, you know, I had a bunch of childhood friends that I'd made friends with and we played soccer a bunch and just a neat couple of years. I was, 10 through 13. So that was a fun couple of years in my life early on. But we came back from Indonesia and Dad went back to seminary to get his master's and we went to Norfolk after that. And he had a church there. And that's where I went to high school. You know, I hear a lot of people talk in the rooms that they started drinking here and they automatically knew that they felt like they were an alcoholic as soon as they drank that first time. And that wasn't my case. That's not exactly what happened to me. I do remember, though, I remember my first drink. And I remember one of the times that sticks out to me is, I guess I was a sophomore or junior in high school. And some of us would get together and get some beers and go down to the end of this cul-de-sac and park and hang out and just listen to music and drink. And that was the time when I remember sitting on this guy's hood of his car and I had a six pack and he had his six pack and there were a couple of the cars parked around there and a guy from one of the cars next to us was hollering at us to come over. Hey, he had some dope. He said, come on over here and now we'll get high. And I just looked at Mark, the guy next to me, and I said, nah, I'm good. You know, I had that six pack sitting right there and we were kicked back sitting on the hood of his car and had the music blasting. And I just remember that feeling of being, okay, I am good. You know, I've got the six pack here. I don't need any dope. I'm fine. And it's weird how that sticks out of my memory, but I remember that, you know, that sense of ease and comfort the book talks about. And I went, you know, boy, looking back on it, seeing from there what happened. And I ended up going to college. I was a pretty good soccer player and I played soccer in college on a small scholarship. And that's when my drinking really kicked into second gear. Oh, started drinking a lot. And that was the beginning of, I wouldn't say my alcoholic drinking, but that's when I started to put drinking before schoolwork, before other important stuff, relationships. And I ended up getting asked to leave college. I went to a little small junior college in Western North Carolina and it was a Christian school and they didn't allow alcohol on campus, which that sure didn't fit into my agenda too well, but got caught drinking on campus a couple of times and got in some more trouble and ended up me and another guy were both asked to leave. And I had all the justifications and all the reasonings behind that school. What was too strict? They didn't understand. Da 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 da. I was just having a few beers at, you know, after a night of partying out in the room with some pizza. And, you know, I could make all the excuses, but the fact was I just didn't obey the rules. And that started a long, next probably 15, 20 years of drinking of me not wanting to obey the rules too much in life. And boy, moved to Charlottesville, Virginia and got married, married my old high school sweetheart. And we were married for a couple of years and split up and got back together. And you know, we're going two separate directions. And as I look back on that time, she was a great lady, fun. Well, going, she was finishing up her degree at University of Virginia, and we were going two separate directions. She was with the sorority girls and doing their thing. And for the last couple of years, I'd been hanging out with the dope smoking bluegrass picking guys. That's the direction that I was heading. And so we were just going two separate directions, and we both realized that. And it was, we split, I won't say amicably at that time, but I did some things that were very hurtful to her. And later on, I had a chance to make an amends a lot later on. It's funny how God will put those amends or people in front of you when his time is right, when the time is right. So fast forward, boy, the next 10 years, lived in Charlottesville, Virginia, was working in the restaurant business, tending bar, and, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, in that 10 years, that's kind of a blur. This was late 70s, early 80s. That's, you know, I can tell you 100 drunk logs about trouble and DUIs and all that stuff, but we know that. We all know how to do that. And what I do remember about that time was feeling that not the loneliness, that would come later on, but feeling kind of a sense of life without purpose. I was enjoying what I was doing. I was having a good time, was making good money, bouncing from, you know, this girlfriend to that girlfriend and living here, living there. And it was just, turmoil is not the right word. It was just one of those times when I was happy-go-lucky, but and deep down inside, there was that lack of purpose. I didn't feel like my life was going anywhere. I'd had a long-term goal of wanting to own my own restaurant, and the guys that I was working for owned a neat place and said, you know, stay with us for another 5 years, and we'll help you buy your own restaurant. And so that was kind of my plan, but I ended up getting into some trouble and had started dating a lady who was graduating from law school at UVA, and she had gotten a job down in Southside, Virginia. So we made a decision to move down there together, and it was perfect timing because I had gotten into some serious trouble, and it was a good time for me to leave Charlottesville, and I did. And my drinking started, and I had been drinking alcoholically for that 10 years. The consequences were starting to creep up. I had a lot of busted relationships and a lot of, I had had a couple of DUIs then. And then we moved down to Southside, Virginia. I'd forgotten about this. I got my third DUI. I remember going to court about that, and the judge mandated me to attend, I don't know, 6 or 7 AA meetings. I had no idea what AA was all about. I knew that it had something to do with not drinking. Anyway, I remember going to my very first AA meeting, and before I went by the house and did a couple of shots and a couple of bong hits, and went to my first meeting just to take the edge off of, because I didn't know what you guys were about. I didn't have any idea. But I knew I couldn't quit drinking, and the liquor was causing a whole bunch of problems. And so I go to my first AA meeting and sit on the back row. And when they ask if anybody's there for the very first meeting, nope, I ain't raising my hand. I look around the room, and I'm like, I'm under the radar. I don't want you guys to know me. I don't want to know y'all. I just want to be under the radar, see who in the world is supposed to sign this paper of mine after the meeting so I can get out of there and go back to the house and start drinking. And that was my very first time. I remember walking in that meeting, and I didn't know it. It was a speaker meeting. And back then, we smoked in the meetings, and I remember walking in there and seeing everybody smoking and a cup of coffee in their hands and thinking, man, look at this cloud of smoke. And, you know, who are these people? And this guy told his story, and I don't remember any of his story, but everybody was laughing and joking. And I was like, man, this ain't funny. You know, I got all this bad stuff happening in my life. Ain't nothing funny in my life. So anyway, I went for a few more meetings to get my paper signed and get my license back. And then, you know, God was gracious enough to allow me to stay out there for another 10 years. And I don't want to say you stay out there because I never came in, but to continue the life that I was living. And that's when things really started getting tough. I had met a lady, and we had gotten serious. She was not the attorney that I moved down there with. She was a nurse at a local hospital. We got married, and I said, okay, boy, here we go. Out of all the relationships I've been in, I finally met this lady I'm in love with, and we're going to settle down and have a family, and time for me to get this drinking and partying under control now. And that didn't happen. And it's, you know, that great perception of us alcoholics. We think that we got all these great intentions of stopping and, you know, I'm going to get married and have children and settle down. And I got this lovely wife and everything's going to be okay. And that doesn't happen. I don't quit drinking. I remember I tried a couple of times just to cut back, to cut back a little bit. And I got another DUI. And by this time, we had moved to Lynchburg and Virginia, and then we moved to Asheville, North Carolina. And I worked at a restaurant in Asheville for about 6 years, and I'm skipping over that. 6 years was a lot of, you know, getting married and had a couple of kids. I was drinking. My drinking hadn't stopped. It had continued. And got to the point where, you know, we get to, you know, can't live with it and can't live without it. And I had shifted gears and got out of the restaurant business and gone in the insurance business and was working for an old buddy of mine that I'd gone to college with in Asheville, and thought that would be the ticket, you know, change jobs, get out of the restaurant business, get out of that crazy party atmosphere and get a real job. And, you know, as alcoholics, we make those geographical changes. We make job changes, wife changes, whatever. And if you're a real alcoholic like me, that drinking just doesn't stop, you know? And in most cases, it gets worse and we get worse. At least I did. That's what happened. She asked me to leave, and rightfully so. I had not been faithful in our marriage, and she asked me to leave, and that was the beginning of the last, 18 months of my drinking, the last year and a half of my drinking, and the downhill spiral. But, boy, now, I had gone to treatment once before, that same place in Charlotte. Got out, stayed sober 30-some days, and I didn't go to meetings. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't do the things that y'all suggested. And you know what? One day I'm rolling down the mountain, literally driving down the mountain. And I see this little store and the Budweiser sign's flashing. And just like that, I walk in and get a six-pack of beer and walk out. And I'm thinking, I'll just go back to the hotel room. We were on the road. I was working for the insurance company, and we were on the road and staying at a hotel. And just like that, bam. Boy, I started back then, and I did not have a clue how bad it was going to get, how quick. That next 18 months was just, miserable. I didn't go to any meetings. Finally, what pushed me to that final, going into treatment, that final place, and that I told you about winding up out in California. I had been to, enough meetings, and I had known that you guys were there for me. And I knew that AA was there. It was just when my wife asked me to leave, she ended up taking the kids and moving back to Virginia to her home place. Here I was stuck with me again, the loneliness, those hideous four horsemen that the book talks about. And that last year and a half of drinking was exactly where I was at every day. I wound up going back to that treatment center where I'd been, and Lady Elizabeth was the counselor there. It was, what an angel. And we discussed long-term treatment then, and I'd gotten a glimpse and read enough in the book to have a clue that you guys knew what you were talking about. So when I got back from California, and I'm flipping back around now, I get back from Asheville and walk around the mountains with my dad for 3 days, sweating it out and just, asking for God's help and direction. And I wound up going to Atlanta, to that place that I was supposed to have gone to when I first got out. And the deal was you had to stay there for 90 days. It was a halfway house situation and a 90-day commitment. And I said, okay, I'll do it. I don't like big cities. I love the mountains of Western North Carolina, but I will go do this deal for 90 days. And lo and behold, 13 years later, I was still in Atlanta and still sober. How in the world does that happen? And that's what, if I could share anything with the newcomers, boy, if you find a home group and you find a network, a group of AAs where they're in the solution, and don't discount God's plan for you. Because I went down there with every intention of staying 90 days and hurrying on back up to Asheville. And it was just, that's not what God had in store for me. And I would have never in a million years guessed that would have happened. But I found a good home group. Stayed sober. I worked with some guys. I shifted gears and got into car business. Three or four of the guys that I worked with were in the program. We all had big books on our desk. And for 8 years, I was just doing the deal, staying sober, going to work. The mother of my children and I had divorced, and I ended up remarrying a little AA lady in Atlanta, and I'll say she 13 stepped me right down the aisle, and there would be some truth to that fact. But she had much more time in the program than I did, and we got married, and God bless her, 2 years into our marriage, she decided she wasn't an alcoholic, and she had 8 years, and she told me that she was just manic, depressive, bipolar, crazy. She wasn't an alcoholic, so her and her girlfriend were going to go drink the next day. And I thought, boy, oh boy. that's another story for another time, but God bless her. She's sober now, and we've been divorced for a number of years. But let me tell you about an experience that I had down there right after I was, early sobriety. I had just picked up my 90-day chip. I had gotten kicked out of Mar where I was at, not for drinking or drugging or anything. You know, I'd been fraternizing with the Marettes a little too much, and they asked me to leave. And so, here I was once again in that spot where, you know, I had known from the time that I got dumped off at that little motel room in California, that when you push me in a corner, or you back me up, or toss me aside, or throw me away, any of those situations, I haul ass to the liquor store without a shadow of a doubt. That's what I do. And here was a time where I got kicked out and had enough money to go stay in a little motel 3 days, 4 days, whatever. And I'm in Atlanta and I call my sponsor. I walk in the motel room right there and I'm praying right off the bat. And I hit my knees in that little room and I'm asking for God's direction. And I call my sponsor and he said, "All right, I'll pick you up in an hour and we'll go over here to a meeting." And we did. And when he dropped me off that night, he said, "Look, tomorrow morning, get you a ride down to Napa." Napa's a big A club in North Atlanta. He said, "Get a ride. See if you can get a ride down to Napa. Stay down there all day long. They got meetings every 2 hours. You just stay down there, sit and listen, share if you want to, but listen." And he said, "Do that every day." He said, "I'll meet you down there for the 5:30 meeting, and then we can come out here to Tucker for the 8 o'clock meeting." But for 3 days, that's what I did. I walked in that meeting. Oh, the day before that, when I'd gotten dropped off down there at Napa, and it was funny because, God bless him, his old timer, he chaired that 10 a.m. meeting. Bob C. was chairing that 10 a.m. meeting, and I walked in Napa, and I had my bags in my hand, and I was 90 days sober, and I was crying, "What am I going to do? Ooh, boo-hoo." And Bob looked at me, and he was standing there in the lobby, and I was going, "Bob, what am I going to do? You know, I got kicked out of Mar. I'm sober. I don't have any money. Don't have any place to go. Blah, blah, blah. Boo-hoo. Poor pitiful me." And I'm just crying. And he looked at me and laughed. And he said, "Wendell, you're not the first drunk to come in here with your bags in your hand, man. Throw your bags over there in the corner and come on in here to the meeting." And I said, "All right. Okay." And I remember throwing my bags in the corner. And I said, "Let me catch a quick smoke." So I ran outside and smoked right quick. And I was standing out there, and that was the beginning of the first time that, I remember crying and looking up and going, "God help me, please. I don't want to drink. I don't want to drink today." And I can see the liquor store down a couple of blocks that way, and I can see them boys down there by the bridge that way, and I know what they're doing down there. And I know what's over there at the liquor store. And I'm standing out front of Napa going, "God, please help me. I don't want to drink today." And just looking up at the blue skies and the white puffy clouds and going, "Help, help me." And turned around and walked back into the meet. And for the first time in my life, I had made a decision. And that was, I didn't know it later on until, until I started working the steps with my sponsors. That was really my third step experience. You know, when I was standing outside that hall and made that decision to turn around and walk back in that meeting. Man, I love the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program. And I came in and I admitted way back before I came in the rooms that I was powerless over alcohol. I tried to fool everybody else into thinking I wasn't an alcoholic for a number of years. After I got sober, I thought my life was still pretty manageable there for a while. But it took me a while to put together the unmanageability. Started working the steps, and oh boy, I remember sitting there in a meeting looking up at the steps on the wall going, "Yep. Okay, One, yep, two, yep, three. Guess I need to start on my four step here. Dang, I guess I need to get a sponsor, don't I? And didn't even have a sponsor, and I'm already at step four by myself. And fortunately did get a sponsor, and I told him I'd already done steps one, two, and three. I was ready to start on step four, and he just kind of chuckled and laughed and said, "Really? All right, well, get your big book out. Let's go back to the beginning here. Why don't you flip back to Roman numeral 11, and we can start at the beginning." Oh, my journey through Alcoholics Anonymous has been unreal. Journey through sobriety. And how do we get there? How do we get here from there? Got here by working the steps with a sponsor. Service work. Huge. I love our little triangle. You know, it says recovery, unity, and service. Because the program of AA to me is, it's more than the 12 steps. It is the 12 steps. And yes, I get it. And I am a firm believer in working the 12 steps with a sponsor as described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an old hardcore Big Book thumper when it comes to that. However, you know, those steps teach us how to live. It's not just how to quit drinking, and quitting drinking is just the beginning of the deal for us. And doing a fourth and a fifth step with a sponsor and looking at my stuff, even early on, not doing the best, I could, but not doing, I guess the most fearless and thorough would be a good way to describe it. But making a humble beginning and starting. Amends. Working through 6, 7 and doing that list and 8 and working with my sponsor. I'll tell you a funny story. I know I've gone for a while here and probably ought to think about closing soon, but I'll give you a quick story, a situation that happened to me. I was 8 years sober, living in Atlanta, and I got, my sponsor had moved across town, and I'd been flying solo without a sponsor. I could still call him my sponsor, but he had gotten married, moved across town, and we didn't go to the same meetings anymore. So I'd gone for a couple of years just flying solo by the seat of my pants there. So not a good idea, folks. Not a good idea at all. I will tell you that. But I was at a meeting in my home group in Decatur, and these two guys ticked me off in the meeting. They were saying a bunch of stuff that I didn't agree with, and there was a newcomer, a first-timer in the room. And I walked out of that meeting so pissed off, and I was just like, you guys, and I was really mad. Because I thought they were saying they were carrying the wrong message to the newcomer. And there was a gentleman outside that had started coming to our group that had long-term sobriety. And I looked at him and he said, "Man, when are you look, man?" I said, "Oh, boy." And I asked Pat, that was Pat, and I asked Pat to be my sponsor the next day. And we started working the steps together. And what I was going to tell you at the end of that story is when I rode home that night and I was fussing and cussing the whole way. And I'm like, okay, I was getting ready to celebrate my 9th anniversary. I was getting ready to pick up my 9th year medallion the next week at that home group. And I was so ticked off at them. And I pulled in the driveway and the headlights of the car were shining on the back part of the garage. And I was sitting there crying, and it was just like the lights were shining on me, and it was like all of a sudden the light bulb went off, and it was just me and God again, and it was obvious. The lights weren't shining on those two fellas at the meeting. They weren't the problem. It was back on me, and I was the problem. And here I was almost nine years sober, and I hadn't been working the deal. I hadn't been sponsoring guys. I hadn't been doing the stuff that I knew worked. And I was at a real dangerous part of my sobriety. I had gone through another sober divorce. And that was another huge turning point in my sobriety. And boy, Pat and I went back through the steps and just, it was a big turning point. I've had the opportunity to make some amends to some people that I really hurt, some ladies, some ex-wives that I did wrong. And, you know, one of those, I told you about my high school sweetheart that I moved to Charlottesville and got married, and we were both going separate ways. On my amends list, she was one of those ones that was, nope, never. And it wasn't because I needed to avoid her or I was afraid to do the amends to her with her. It was just she had moved on. And, you know, it says, except when to do so would injure them or others. And she had a new life and husband and kids, and there was no reason for me to interfere with her life and disrupt and bring any more hurt and pain to her that I had. And so I, that was a living amends. And I ended up, even though she communicated from time to time through social media with my brothers and sisters, I knew not to reach out to her. And lo and behold, we had a class reunion that came up, and she reached out to me and invited me to Facebook page for the class reunion. And that was a cool experience. And that was a few years later, and I went to Norfolk to the first class reunion I had ever gone to, because I never wanted to go because I did not want to face her. God worked that out. That was so cool the way that happened. And we ended up, I was able to make amends to her, not only apologize for the wrongs that I had done, but share a little bit of my experience and where I was at. And lo and behold, through that, I've gotten to help her brother, and he's got 4 years sober now. And anyway, it's been a neat ride. I could go on and tell you about the miracles that have happened to me in sobriety. I'm really fortunate. We are very fortunate. I love service work. I'm real involved with the Area 62 in South Carolina. I've been involved with service work at the district level. And, you know, service is just one of those ways that it never ceases to amaze me how we can reach out, how we can help, what we do right, what we need some work on, what we're not doing right. That's provided a really neat opportunity for me to explore some different areas in my sobriety that I didn't think that was, you know, that was my forte, or that was what my out of my comfort zone. So anyway, let me read this right quick and I will close up, because this kind of sums up. I'm going to steal this from Sylvia Kaufman's The Keys to the Kingdom, but I love this last page, and it kind of sums up my life in sobriety and before. And this is from it's the last page of that story, The Keys to the Kingdom, but it really does sum up everything. In the last 28 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of real problems, heartaches, and disappointments. And because that's life, you know, I've had a great deal of joy and of peace. It's a handmaiden of inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, with my A friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First, through mutual pain and despair. Later, through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. As the years have gone by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love. Without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There's no more loneliness. There's no more that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. The ache is gone and need never return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we've been given the keys to the kingdom. Love y'all. Thank you for letting me share, Tara. I appreciate being here today.
Thank you, Wendell. Thank you so much for your story. It has this thread of faith throughout it, which I really appreciated. And I'm going to ask you questions on in a minute, but I want you to have an opportunity to finish up the story with your attorney that laughed at you and you had to go back and deal with it. Did you ever call that attorney back and clean up that?
Oh, yes. Thank you for that reminder. Oh, man. Yes. Oh, okay. 5 years later, after I'm sober in Atlanta, 5 years later, and here I've been driving on a bogus Tennessee license, and my sponsor knew, my wife knew, those were the only two people that knew that I had a old failure to appear warrant in Asheville, and I kept that. That was the only skeleton left in the closet. And that was a cool thing because the secretary of our home group, oh, he would always talk about getting his license back. And he rode the bus and he went and got our anniversary cakes on the bus. And I always felt so much guilt. And I would look at him and go, dang, Kenny's doing all this service work riding the bus. And I'm lying to myself and everybody else about having a license. And lo and behold, what happened was I got pulled over for a no seatbelt one morning, and that started a chain of events that, yes, I had to call that attorney back in Asheville. And at first he said, oh, Wendell, you ready to make this go away? And I said, yeah, and it finally caught up with me. Man, I'm sober 5 years and been living a life of 5 years. I need to go ahead and come back around and make this disappear. And he and I both laughed about it. And he said he thought he could, oh, I don't even think you'll have to come up here to court, man. I think I can get this thing knocked out. The cop that had arrested me that night he had resigned right after that, right after he arrested me, a couple of weeks after he resigned. And he had been gone from the police department. But that wasn't the case. The DA was pretty ticked off because I hadn't bothered to rectify that mistake and had been on the loose for 5 years without paying my dues to them and wanted to make a good example out of me. And boy, oh boy, I went to court with 5 years sober. I went back to court and it was dismissed, and it was a God thing. The policeman that got up and testified just kept telling the DA over and over, I don't know. And even though he and I didn't know each other personally, the DA was really trying to nail me to the wall, but the policeman who they had to subpoena to come to court did not want to be there. And he had been off the police force for 5 years and he did not want to be there. And it was a total God thing the way that happened, but it ended up being dismissed. And I walked out of that courtroom after hugging my attorney and in tears. And I saw the cop out in the hallway and I ran up to him and, as a matter of fact, my wife at the time ran up and hugged him first, and he looked at me, and I went over and shook his hand, and I said, man, I've been sober for 5 years, and I know you didn't have to say what you said up there, but, and he said, I just told the truth, Wendell. And I just hugged him, and I was once again grateful that there's God doing for me what I could not do for myself, and it was a cool thing. It was one of those God moments.
Seems like you have a lot of those.
Yes, I have.
You had said early on, if I heard you correctly, God was gracious enough to leave you out there for another 10 years drinking.
Yep.
What did you mean by gracious? Or what did you mean by that?
God was gracious enough to allow me to stay out there for another 10 years because, oh, looking back on that, I had gotten a little snippet of AA going to those 5 or 6 meetings and not wanting to get sober, not thinking that I was a real alcoholic. I wasn't as bad off as you guys were. That was only my 3rd DUI. And when I said God was gracious enough to allow me to stay out there for another 10 years, I mean that he was gracious enough to allow me to experience the pain, the hurt, the loneliness, the despair that I lived through and managed to come crawling back in AA 10 years later. And I do feel that, you know, there's so many of us that don't make it back. And I couldn't really say that I was in the AA to start with because, I mean, I wasn't doing anything but going to meetings to get my paper signed. So I couldn't say I was in AA and went back out. But when he's gracious enough to let me go out there, I just really feel like that was one of those gifts that, you know, we all have little opportunities, that little moments when God throws us a bone or gives us some direction and we have an opportunity to get sober and we might blow it off or might not take advantage of it. And then we continue on. And some of us die. Some of us don't make it. Some of us wound up in prison. And when I finally got sober and got back in here and realized that the stuff that I had done in that last 10 years, and it was grace. It was his grace in allowing me to go through that and to walk through that and live and to be able to share that with others now and to be able to sponsor guys and to share, you know, sobriety and what it means to me. And I do that on a lot of different levels these days, but that's the best way I don't know how to describe. How do you describe God's grace or graciousness? I don't know. Being alive, being sober, the ability to love and feel love and return love. That's about as, I don't know.
Well, that's better than you being sarcastic when you said it, because that was a possibility too.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't mean for it to sound sarcastic when I said it.
It didn't. I didn't think that that's how you meant it. You talked about, do you have a few more minutes?
Yeah, okay, sure.
Because I have a couple more questions. So curious about you came back from California that October of 1994. So 27, 28 years ago, you walked around with your dad for 3 days. Is that what I heard you say?
Yes. Yeah.
And he's
went up.
Let's hear about that.
he picked me up in Asheville, and he lives up in the mountains. He lived up in the mountains, west of North Carolina. He died in 15, but I had to try to get a game plan together on what I was going to do. I was broke, and I walked around the mountains. It's beautiful up there, and I call it God's country, and it's just real peaceful. And you know, I was sick and getting out the poison from that last 4-day drunk, trying to decide what I was going to do and asking for God's direction. And Dad would say, well, let's go walking. You know, my dad and I used to fish a lot together, and we love fishing together. And he used to tell me, I do my best praying when I'm out there fishing. We'd laugh and we'd tell stories and joke with each other, but walking around the mountains and spending some time with my dad was really neat. I my dad and I were real close. And I had to try to figure out what I was going to do, what, you know, if I could call Mar back in Atlanta and see if, you know, it was still a possibility for me to come back there, because I had blown them off and stood them up and walked away, you know, a couple of months before that. And I didn't have any money. They wanted $500 for me to come on in and check in. I did call Doug down there, Mar, and he was the director of the men's program. And I called him and he said, "Yeah, I wondered what happened to you." And I said, "Yeah, well, you know, I took a left instead of a right. And been out in California and was sober for whatever, 30 some days. And then I got drunk last week and I'm just coming off my, you know, 4 day drunk and I've been sober." He said, "Well, you need to at least detox and stay sober for 3 or 4 days before I can let you come in the program down here." And I said, "All right, I'll hang out up here with my dad for 3 or 4 more days. And that'll give me a chance to see if I can beg, borrow, steal, ask somebody for some money. I don't know where I'm going to get this $500. I had insurance, but he wanted me to, I had to have $500 to come up with to check in down there." So that was the beginning of me, and talking about honesty, I had to call an uncle of mine and ask him for $500 that I didn't know when I could repay or if I could ever repay it, and admit to him that I was an alcoholic and that I needed to go to treatment. And this was an uncle who was one of us, and he never got sober, and he knew I had talked to him about my struggles before. We were out fishing one day on his boat, and he was real tickled that I got sober, because he never did. It was, I called and asked him for the money, and he sent it to me, and we talked afterwards after I got sober and stuff, but he lent me the money so I could walk around, you know. And there's 3 days walking around in the mountains, Terry, to be honest with you. It was tough stuff because, you know, I'm walking around with my dad and enjoying my dad's company, and at the same time I have to stop and puke and sweating it out and drinking water, trying to get my mind and body to feel right again. And at the same time, feeling so, one more time, such a disappointment, such a, you know, I had not only disappointed my family a bunch of times and wives and ex-wives, but once again, I felt like I disappointed God and disappointed myself, and I was just really bummed out, you know. So walking around the mountains for a couple of days with my dad kind of helped me get, not only helped me detox and get sober, and I got some reassurance that everything was going to be okay, that I didn't need to figure it all out. And, you know, even though I didn't know what God had in store for me, that I didn't have to freak out about it, and I didn't have to feel so desperate and bummed out like I had been feeling. Like I felt after, you know, every time I drank or every time I did something really stupid or crazy in my life. And, you know, my dad gave me a ride back. He gave me a ride tomorrow after, I don't know, I was up there in the mountains 3 or 4 days, and he gave me a ride tomorrow down in Atlanta. And he dropped me off. And we talked about this later on after I'd been sober for a number of years. He dropped me off. Once again, there I was with my bags, strange place, strange center. And here I was, a new beginning. And he told me later on, he walked back out to his car and he just remembered, you know, saying, "Okay, God, you know, that's your boy. You need to take care of him, not me." And it was kind of a neat kind of new beginning for me and him both. Because it started, not only started a whole new journey in my sobriety, but it's kind of a big deal to him of really letting go of me And he was never an enabler or codependent. But I will say this, and this is funny, because years later, after I've been sober for a number of years, I asked him one day, we were sitting out on his front porch on the mountains talking, and I said, "Dad, you ever think about what would have happened if I had called you and said, 'Hey, I'm drunk. I need you to come get me out of jail,' or 'I messed up and crashed another car,' or 'Whatever, come get me,' or whatever, like I had done numerous times before?" He said, "Yeah," he said, "it's funny you mentioned that." He said, "I've thought about that several times." And I said, "Well, what would you have done?" And he said, "Well, I'd have come and picked you up. I'd have given you a hug and told you I loved you. And I'd have taken you right back over there to West Asheville to the Red Roof Inn where I picked you up. And I'd have dropped you off and said, 'Son, I love you. I can't do this anymore.'" And I was like, "Damn, really?" He said, "Yeah." Said, "I'm glad you stayed sober." I said, "Me too." We laughed about it. But, you know, like I said, when he took me down to Mar and dropped me off, and that was kind of another big turning point for our relationship, because our relationship was never the same again. It was always good, and it got better in sobriety. And he taught me how to fish sober. That was something new and different. But it was a neat time. You know, when you walk around the mountains and you're feeling bummed out and desperate and disappointing and worthless and all those negative feelings that I feel when I've pulled another stunt, when I've been on another binge or roll like I had done, and that, that feeling of God's reinsurance, that God's grace. There we go. God's grace comes down one more time and just kind of reassures me that it's going to be okay. And that was the kind of the tipping point or turning point for me and Dad and our relationship. And it was neat.
I imagine he passed very proud of you.
He did. Yeah. He was a neat man. Really neat man. He ended up getting lung cancer, and he still preached in this little mountain church up in the mountains, even though he was semi-retired or whatever. He continued to preach in this little mountain church up there for another 20-some years after he had kind of officially retired. He preached up until, I guess, probably 6 or 7 months before he died. He was diagnosed with lung cancer, and then sometime in that next year, he lived 18 months after he was diagnosed, but sometime in that next year, the chemo got pretty tough and he got pretty sickly, and he quit preaching then, but he was almost 80. And, yeah, he was proud of me. He loved me, and we had some neat times together.
Okay.
Not to, I don't know if you're still on record or not.
We are.
But,
yeah.
Okay. Compare that to my mom died in 88 of cancer. And I showed up at the hospital in Charlotte, a drunk mess. Not any help whatsoever to my siblings or my dad. And I was a drunk mess. And I showed up in the hospital and my mom was dying. And that was, you know, look at the contrast in that and the way I ended the relationship with my dad. Not that my mama didn't love me. She did. And you know, She had told me a long time before that I was going to go my way and do my thing, and it was okay because she had already given me over to the Lord, and she didn't worry about me anymore. And I kind of chuckled. That was years before when she came to Charlottesville to see me one time before that. But I had another opportunity. My younger brother passed away who had Down syndrome. And, oh, gosh, I forgot to tell you something else that's really important, too. Daggone it.
We're still recording. You got time.
Okay. I have a younger brother that died with Down syndrome. And he brought more love and unconditional love to our family than anybody could ever imagine. And Jimmy died, Mom died in 88. Jimmy died in 2012, I think. Anyway, when Jimmy died, I was able to take off from work, he was in Hickory, North Carolina, and go be there with him and be there for my brothers and sisters and hold his hand and be there when he took his last breath and make amends and hug him and love up on him and be there and be present for him when he was dying. And such a contrast to showing up years earlier when my mom was in the same situation in Charlotte and on her deathbed, and me showing up as a drunk mess at the hospital, just totally worthless to help anybody. And, you know, going back out to the car in the parking lot and having drinks right out in the parking lot, out of the trunk of the car because I couldn't deal with the pain and the hurt. You know, and then, oh gosh, let me tell you one other thing, and I don't know how you're going to splice this or edit this in. But this is, I have had a bunch of God moments in my life. And I need to tell you about this one, and I don't know how I left this one out. A couple of years ago, April 28th of 2021, my sister called me. There was another brother. We had a younger brother. I had a younger brother that lived in Boone. You know, my two sisters live in Western North Carolina. And Lucy called me. My sister called me. And it was a Wednesday afternoon, April 28th. And she said, there's a police standoff going on in Boone and a bunch of shootout or something that's happened up there today. You know anything about that? And I'm like, no, what are you talking about? And she said, well, it's all over the TVs here in Charlotte and Winston-Salem, and they've had a police standoff for 13 hours, and they keep saying it's up there on Hardeman Circle. Isn't that where George lives? And I said, holy shit. And I ran in the house because he had sent me a birthday card a couple of months before that, and I knew I'd left the envelope out on the counter because I had great intentions of sending him back a thank you card. But he and I were really close, too, and I ran in the house, and I was going, oh, crap. And I grabbed his card. I knew it was Hardeman Circle where he lived, and I had Lucy on the phone. I said, yeah, it's Hardeman Circle. And she said, well, you know, they're saying this, and they're saying that on the news, and I don't know what's going on, blah, blah, blah. And I said, all right, let me call the Watauga County Sheriff's Department and just see if that's close to his house or where it's at up there. I'll call you right back. And I called the sheriff's department up there. And here I am sitting in Hartsville, South Carolina, in my little house down here. I call up the sheriff's department. And, of course, they couldn't tell me anything. And I said, look, my name is Wendell. My brother George lives on Hardeman Circle. I just found out there's been a shooting and a police standoff, and a couple of officers have been shot. I'm not sure where it is happening. Can you tell me if I give you the address? Can you tell me if it's at this address? And he said, I can't tell you anything. And I said, well, my brother George lives at 553 Hardeman Circle, Boone, North Carolina. Can you check with your superiors and just verify if that's the address where this is happening or not? And he put me on hold for a few minutes, and he came back and he said, yes, sir, that is the correct address. That's all I can tell you. And I gave them my name and number and asked them to please notify me if they when and if they could. And hung up and called my sister back. And by this time I grabbed my laptop and pulled it, you know, opened up and was all over the news in Western North Carolina. George and his wife, Michelle, had been murdered. And the police had been called over there because he didn't show up for work that morning. And his work had called, and actually they sent a guy over there to the house to check on him. And his truck was in the driveway and Michelle's car was in the driveway, and guy went up and knocked on the door, and nobody came to the door. And boy, this guy's angel was looking out for him, because he said he knocked and knocked on the door and nobody came to the door, but he said he saw some kind of movement in the back of the house and something just didn't look right, didn't feel right, and it's curtains moving or something. So he went back out to his car and he called the office and told them to call 911 and get a welfare check out there. And he waited in his car and for the cops to get there, and the cops got there and he told them that he'd been there and nobody had answered the door. And they went up and knocked and knocked on the door and nobody came to the door, and they busted the door in, and oh, it wasn't pretty. It was real, real ugly. And two officers were killed. One of them was life flighted out of there. They were able to, the SWAT teams got there and were able to retrieve one of the officers upstairs and got him life flighted out of there. And he died later on that evening in the hospital across the mountain over in Johnson City. And the other officer that was trapped down below had gotten killed. And they had all been killed by George's stepson. His wife, Michelle, had been married before and had two kids, and their son, his stepson, Isaac, just flipped, and he had gotten a summons for jury duty about a week before that, and he had had some mental health problems and had never been diagnosed, and his mama had tried to get him some help. George and them tried to get him to go to the doctor and get treatment and get diagnosed, and he never would. And he, it's very sad. It was very heartbreaking. And so that being said, we walked through that evening of not knowing at the time, and this was about 5:30 or 6 at Wednesday night, of not knowing if he was alive or dead, if Michelle was alive or dead. One of the officers was in the house downstairs. We didn't know if he was alive or dead. And the police, the SWAT teams were all there, and they had the armored car and the robots and the drones and all that stuff. And, you know, none of us could do anything. And that's a helpless feeling. And that's all happening up 300 miles away from where I am. And nobody could get close to it anyway. And so, midnight that night, they finally called Peggy, who is Michelle's mom, and was the actual homeowner of the house where they were living. And she lived down in North Carolina, and they called her. And all they told her was that they had raided the house and it had been was evacuated, and there were 5 deceased bodies that were removed from the house. And we could only assume, we had to know that that was, you know, my brother and his wife and 2 cops and Isaac, who was their son. That was some tough stuff, lady. How do you walk through that? And, oh, once again, grace, prayer. God help me. How do I deal with this? How do I walk through this stuff? And it was right in the middle of the COVID and the pandemic and stuff. And oh, me. The silver lining to that story is, in my only prayer when all that happened, and they asked me to be the executor and to go up there and handle everything because my two sisters were real distraught and neither one of them could do any of that stuff. And I wasn't working, and so that was fine. I got to be the big brother that I was supposed to be and go take care and handle that stuff. And it was really tough. It was tough stuff. You know, you walk through it with, you know, all the feelings of grief, all the stages of grief that continue to come and go. But my only prayer through it has been that God use that situation and use that horrific, tragic episode for all of them, for all the families involved, and to use it for his good and his glory and to do something good out of that. And through that, the lady that's a pastor of the church up there, the little Presbyterian church where George was a member, has formed a, along with a bunch of other clergy members and a couple of people in recovery and some mental health folks, they now have a Watauga County Community Mental Health Resource Committee, and they are doing some really good work and reaching out to all different facets of the community, you know, with the recovery community, with the police departments, with the school. There's a couple of school counselors that are on that, and I've had the opportunity to participate in witness what they're doing and how they're trying to, you know, relieve the stigma of mental illness. Because that was the whole thing with Isaac, that, you know, he was mentally ill and didn't want to go get diagnosed and was afraid. And there was a lot of other problems. But, you know, why my brother didn't reach out to me, I'll never know. And that doesn't matter anymore. But it really bugged me right after it happened for a while, because it was my heart broke, because he had obviously been in a sad situation for about a year prior to that with a lot of stuff that was going on up there. I kept going, man, bro, why didn't you just reach out and talk to me? You know, because he knew I was in recovery and he knew I've had some sponsees that were batshit crazy for a while. So, you know, I don't think it would have been uncomfortable for him to talk to me about, but obviously it was. So anyway, I'm just still continuing to pray that, you know, God use that for his good, because it was horrific, tragic, ugly stuff. And how do you walk away from that and say, okay, God, thank you for today. Thank you for my sobriety today. Yeah. Sorry, didn't mean to get long-winded on you there.
No, I just now wrote this morning that when difficulties and tragedies touch my life, I pray that I have the strength and grace to make it to the other side. And
I heard you and your story, and the lady that hosted for you make the comments about the God stuff being for the weak and wimpy. And I laughed and said, yeah, ain't it though? Because that's what we think. That's what we feel. Or this alcoholic thinks and feels, until life smacks me right in the face and throws some really tough stuff at me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just another good reminder, just like my sobriety, that, oh, God, I am not in charge today. I have no idea what somebody else's pain looks like today, what their desperation looks like today, and it comes back to, okay, God, what can I do to be of help today? What can I do to be of service today?
For more information, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, or visit keepcomingback.net.